This episode of Registry Matters is proudly brought to you by our amazing pledge patrons, Justin, Brian, Michael, Stephen, Rachel. Your support makes this podcast possible. Thank you. And don't forget, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, more West to be included. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 350 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. What's up over there?
Well, it's not as toasty as it has been. It's only 91 today, so we're coming down into
only 91.
We're coming down to the downside slope of the summer season.
Fantastic. Be sure to head over, show your support by hitting like and subscribe, thumbs up buttons, 5-star reviews. Those are great ways that you can show support for the program. It really makes a difference for all those crazy algorithms that follow that kind of stuff. And if you're feeling extra generous, please head over to patreon.com, and any support would help us out and be incredibly valued. So, Larry, what are we up to tonight?
Well, good news is Chance is able to join us today. And that means not just Mr. Doom and Gloom for this episode. He has a California Corner segment coming your way. Our main event is we have a case from the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And it's a huge win for PFRs, at least like last week for the moment. And we have a couple of articles, if time permits.
Until they change it.
Until they change it.
Well, let's dive right into the deep end. You put this thing in here from the Ninth Circuit, and that's West Coast stuff, correct?
Yes.
And isn't that the circuit that Supreme Court used to overturn, that they usually overturn most frequently?
It is. It used to be overturned frequently. That was when it was dominated by a bunch of liberal communist sympathizers like Stephen Reinhart. But Trump has packed it with rational thinkers, so they don't get overturned as much as they used to.
Wouldn't the Ninth Circuit be the antithesis of ideology against the Supreme Court?
Well, that's something it was, but Trump fixed that during his first term in office. You know, you had several replacements on that circuit, and now it's packed with rational thinkers, and those communist sympathizers were out of there.
I see. I figured that it was still kind of a left-leaning institution. All right, well then. I certainly don't agree that they would be the most rational of people. Anyway, but the case that we're going to talk about is a Bradley Bagansky? Is that what we're going with? Bagansky?
Either way, Bagansky or Bagansky.
Oh, sorry, Bagansky. Okay, so we'll do Bradley Bagansky versus David Shin, and that's the director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. The decision was released just only a few days ago, actually on August 12th, so 4 days ago as we're recording this. Now, you claim it's a win.
It is. The 3-judge panel reversed the district judge denial of Bagansky's habeas petition, and that petition was challenging his Arizona jury conviction for child molestation and was remanded with instructions to issue the writ of habeas corpus, which the trial judge had denied. That is a rarity, and it is good news.
Well, look, I read over the case. I went to a picnic today with a whole bunch of friends, and I was reading it while I was at the picnic. There was a shrimp boil. We had andouille sausage and all that stuff. And as I was reading it, I couldn't help but be reminded of an individual named Stephen May, and a case that we covered multiple times. He got shafted in the Ninth Circuit, as I recall. Am I on the right track there?
You are.
Now, I recall that a habeas judge had declared Arizona CM statute unconstitutional. Would you go into Arizona statute a little bit?
Yes. What kind of statute did you say CM? What is that?
I chose to not say the words out loud that you already said.
Okay, CM. Okay, so it's already been said.
It has been said.
Okay, Arizona defines CM of a child as any direct or indirect touching of the private parts of a child. That's it. During the relevant period for Bagansky's case, the state provided an affirmative defense if the defendant could show by preponderance of the evidence that he was not motivated by sexual interest. Despite that, a jury found Bagansky guilty of CM, despite him putting forth the affirmative defense that he was not motivated when he helped bathe girls placed in his care through the foster care system. He and his wife were taking care of foster children, and so he said that that was the reason why he was bathing them.
So I wasn't losing my mind with the similarity and the eerily similar case with Stephen May. He was a lifeguard who had touched a minor in the course of his duties, as I recall.
That's correct.
Well, then, with your amazing storytelling skills, can you refresh the audience on what the term affirmative defense means?
I do my best, but we actually have a real lawyer here, and he can backfill what I miss. An affirmative defense is when you do not contest the commission of the underlying deed. For example, killing a person and claiming it was done in self-defense is a classic example of an affirmative defense. The accused admits, yeah, I shot the son of a bitch, but he asserts it was in self-defense. And then the burden shifts to the accused, usually by a much lesser standard, to prove that the act was done in self-defense. And there are many affirmative defenses. Not guilty by insanity is another example of an affirmative defense. But yes, you're basically, you put yourself at the mercy when you assert an affirmative defense, because you can't really assert it without saying, yeah, I done it. But Chance, can you make it gooder than what I've done?
No, can't make it gooder. That sounds pretty textbook to me.
All right. Well, in this case, the panel held that Arizona's statute scheme unconstitutionally shifted the burden of disproving an essential element of the crime of CM to the defendant, contrary to the due process clause of the 14th Amendment.
And the irony is they relied on the exact same cases that Stephen May relied on. Those were Patterson versus New York from 1977, Mulaney versus Wilbur from 1975, and Henry Winship, which I've not read that case to my recollection, from 1970. But this is long. This is well-plowed earth, as they say in the South, in terms of shifting the burden, and this is what Arizona has done.
Now, I've heard that you have thought about for years that nobody succeeds in overturning a state conviction in federal habeas court due to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. This is the second time that Arizona statute has been overturned in habeas proceedings in federal court. Now, can you admit that people do win?
Yeah, occasionally they do. This despite the fact that Representative Henry Hyde and the Newt Gingrich crowd really totally gutted federal habeas in 1996 when they passed the AEDPA. But nonetheless, the panel concluded that under the standards set forth by the AEDPA, the Arizona Court of Appeals decision upholding Bagansky's conviction therefore involved an objectively unreasonable application of legal principles clearly set forth in decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, which is what you have to show. Is it can't be an appellate level decision. It has to be from the highest court of the land. But yes, people occasionally win.
And I thought we were supposed to defer to the state's highest court. The opinion states the Arizona Supreme Court has held that the offense is complete when the child is knowingly or intentionally touched, because the crime of CM does not mention, imply, or require sexual motivation. That was so decided in State versus Holly or Hall, I don't know, H-O-L-L-E, and that's a 2016 case.
That is correct. AEDPA does require deference. That was one of the great pride and joys of Henry Hyde, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, I believe at the time of the 90s, and Newt Gingrich for gutting federal habeas, because all these whiny state prisoners were going into the federal courts and clogging that system up just with complaint after complaint after complaint about how they had been railroaded. And therefore, they wanted to stop all this nonsense and make these have finality. But the AEDPA does require deference, except when the determination is in direct conflict with the U.S. Supreme Court decision. But during the period relevant to this appeal, Arizona provided an affirmative defense if the defendant could show by preponderance of the evidence that he was not motivated by sexual interest. But as I said earlier, in 2017, a jury found Bradley Bagansky guilty of CM despite his defense he was not sexually motivated when he helped bathe girls in the care of he and his wife in the foster care system.
Would you remind me what preponderance, what level that is? Is that the 50 plus one?
Yes, it's slightly tipping the scale above Well, when you see those scales of justice, when you flip it just a little bit in favor of one party, that would be my definition. Chance, do you have a similar definition, or am I on the right track?
Yeah, preponderates by 1% over the 50 mark. That's exactly right.
Oh, good.
Now, whenever I think about those scales of justice, I always think of like the Encyclopedia Britannica sitting on one side that you've got to try and lift it out of that. But you know, it's not possible for a man to bathe females without a sexual motivation. Of course, like you would take your children and you would be like, haha, it's bath time. Right?
I didn't actually know that, but I know that's the theory out there. So you got to understand, men are horn dogs and women are pure as the wind driven snow. So if a woman bathes a boy, it's all for the best of intentions. And if a man bathes a female, he's getting some kind of pleasure. And it's kind of like searching in prison. You know how they don't let male guards search female prisoners?
Yes.
But the other way around, it's okay because the women don't get all horned out about this kind of stuff.
I never had a female search me.
So
you're trying to say there's a double standard there?
It sounds like it. It definitely sounds like it. Now, the court covered the history of the statute since Arizona became a state. And that was in 1913 in Larry's like teenage kind of years. Would you agree that you were roughly a teenager in the 13 timeframe?
I'd already served in the Lincoln administration as a deputy official. So no, I was well into adulthood by 1913.
I see. All right. Well, then much, much later in 1965, Arizona substantially revised the statute. The new version provided a relevant part. A person who molests a child under the age of 15 years by fondling, playing with, or touching the private parts of such child, or who causes a child under the age of 15 years to fondle, play with, or touch private parts of such a person shall be guilty of a felony.
Yes, that's what I saw in my history. So you're reading the same case. And shortly after the legislature enacted this 1965 version, a defendant challenged it as unconstitutionally vague, arguing that it was applicable to such people as parents and doctors who might touch a child's private parts for other than condemning reasons. And that was a case decided in State versus Berry in 1966. The Arizona Supreme Court rejected that argument, concluded that the statute proscribes certain easily recognizable acts which, combined with a necessary intent, constitute a violation, except there's no intent required. That's the funny thing, but that's what they said. The court resisted the defendant's argument that the statute did not expressly incorporate an element of scienter, which is knowledge, and thus the statute could not convict innocent-minded people, which it could have and has. The Arizona Supreme Court read into the act a requirement that the state prove abnormal sexual motivation, reasoning that when the words annoy or molest are used in reference to an offense against children, there's a connotation of abnormal sexual motivation on the part of the offender. Now, this is courts legislating from the bench at the finest. Therefore, a doctor or parent may touch the private parts of a child without molesting him by doing so and without violating the child molestation statute. In other words, they invented and inserted an imaginary requirement that the state proves scienter.
And this probably is a time when you would be okay with them legislating from the bench, I'm guessing.
Yes. If you're on the defense side, you would be okay with it.
I noted that Arizona made two additional changes to the scienter requirement in the 1970s. Would you dig into that?
Yes. In 1978, the legislature changed molest to knowingly molest, which is good. That puts scienter in play. In 1983, the legislature made explicit what was implicit in the 1965 law after the Supreme Court's decision in Berry. It was a defense to CM if the defendant was not motivated by sexual interest.
And then so scienter was required to be proven in 1978 and then converted to an affirmative defense in 1983? While I was eating my lunch, did I figure that one out?
I think you did. That's the way I interpret it, yes.
Then how did the statute evolve from there?
Well, it's getting funnier. Following the adoption of this defense, Arizona courts were divided over whether the statute must still prove that the defendant had touched a child with some kind of sexual interest. First, in Re Maricopa Juvenile action, the Arizona Court of Appeals revisited whether abnormal sexual motivation was still an element of CM. And that was a 1992 decision. The court held that the statute still required the state to prove the defendant's sexual motivation, but that abnormal motivation was no longer the standard, just sexual motivation, noting that the legislature had added the defense of lack of sexual interest in that section that we've talked about, 13-1407. The court reasoned that the element of abnormal or unnatural sexual interest was superseded by the less stringent statutory defense of lack of sexual interest. Now, this is getting very blurry, even for me.
I'm trying to understand what abnormal or unnatural interest would be. I'm trying to figure out what an example of that would be.
Yes, yeah, so that's why I'm saying it's getting very blurry. Although the court also suggested there was little substantive difference between the two, even if the former standard was ever meant to do anything more than distinguish criminal conduct from innocent conduct. For example, the act of a physician treating a child or the parent bathing in private parts. But again, this has gotten so fuzzy that it seems like this thing's been unconstitutional for decades.
And you know, I have a child, and of significant importance is that those pieces of body, they need to be cleaned, whether it's boy or girl. In my case, I have a boy, and you got to clean the back end and you got to clean the front end, and girls would be the same. Like, your skin doesn't get super dirty because it's kind of exposed to the air, and like, but the stuff that's contained inside, like underwear and all that, and you got diapers on, you got to clean that stuff. So how could you not, like, what are you supposed to do? You get a fire hose or a pressure washer and do it at distance?
I suppose so. You need to ask the great liberty lovers that are serving in the Arizona legislature.
I noticed that in a criminal omnibus bill in 1997, the Arizona legislature substantially revised its framework for affirmative defenses. The legislature amended Arizona revised statute 13-103 to abolish common law affirmative defense and added subsection 13-205, which required a defendant to prove an affirmative defense by a preponderance of the evidence. And that is from a 1997 amendment. Now, before that time, Arizona common law provided that the burden of proof regarding an affirmative defense shifted back to the prosecution after the defendant presented any evidence of the defense. Now, is this where the problem begins?
I would say it's where the problem certainly got far worse, but the problem's been around a long time. In 1997, they codified the affirmative defense does not include any defense that either denies an element of the offense charge or denies responsibility, including alibi, misidentification, or lack of intent. And I don't know how to explain that. That's why we got Chance here. read that next one. Oh, no, I'll go ahead and read it. If I had to explain
it. Can you explain it, please?
If I had to explain it, I would say the victim advocate apparatus and the law enforcement apparatus convinced the legislature that the criminals were exploiting a massive number of loopholes in the system. That's what I think happened.
And because this is so murky and all that, can we keep moving to try to get out of this? What happened next?
You mean you're not absorbing? You've read this how many times?
I've read it, and I'm still trying to figure out what unnatural and abnormal interest would be. I'm really trying hard to figure that one out.
Well, fast forward to 2007. The Arizona Court of Appeals, for the very first time, considered the 1993 version. So this thing managed to bob around for a decade and a half, the 1993 version, before it was made its way up to appellate level. And they looked at the affirmative defense framework, and they decided that sexual interest was no longer an element of CM. And that was in a case called State versus Simpson. And the court held lack of sexual interest under 13-1407E was an affirmative defense that the defendant had to prove by preponderance of the evidence. Second, the court reasoned that because the statute had been updated in 1993 to remove the phrase knowingly molest, prior decisions from the Arizona Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals did not compel the court at this time to interpret it to require proof of sexual interest as an element. They're basically saying that since the legislature changed the wording, we're no longer bound by existing precedent, so we're going to interpret it this way.
Now, you and I have actually like kind of debated in the past of whether you can prove a negative. And you're like, well, if it's not there, you've proven the negative. How would you prove you were not interested?
You can't prove the negative in most instances.
And then a different division of the Arizona Court of Appeals expressly disagreed with the Simpson court's interpretation. I'm going to need you to explain that.
Yes, there was Holly 1. That was the case that you talked about earlier. There's two decisions, Holly 1 and Holly 2. Holly 1 acknowledged that the legislature made lack of sexual interest in a defense to child molestation when it added that section. The court explained that in its view, the 1993 amendment did not significantly alter the elements of CM because it did not do so in the text of the molestation statute itself. Thus, sexual interest remained an implicit element of CM that the state was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt if the defendant raised lack of sexual interest as a defense. They said, to conclude otherwise would force defendants to negate a fact of the crime which the state has to prove in order to convict, violating the defendant's right to due process. In other words, Holly 1 read the legislature's post-Sanderson abolition of common law affirmative defenses and shifting of the burden as proof of its interpretation of sexual interest was an element of the child molestation offense. The court concluded, thus, it was legal error to place the burden on the defendant to prove conduct that was not motivated by sexual interest. Now, that was a good decision. That was Holly 1.
And then the Arizona Supreme Court reversed Holly? Is that what I picked up from all that too?
Yes, the Supreme Court vacated Holly 1, and they held that the plain text, remember we're textualists around here, of section 13-1410 and 13-1401 broadly define sexual contact as any direct or indirect touching, fondling, or manipulating another's private parts, but did not implicate the defendant's motivation. The statutes defining the crimes did not mention, imply, or require sexual motivation. Further, the statutory scheme unequivocally identified lack of motivation as an affirmative defense. And because of lack of sexual interest as an affirmative defense, the legislature may allocate the defendant the burden of proving it. Don't agree with that, but that's what the highest court in the state said. The court held that allocating the burden does not violate due process because the state is still required to prove every element of the CM statute. A lack of sexual motivation only excused conduct that would otherwise be punished. One did not convert any of the elements of the offense, so they said.
Now, was Holly 2? Now, was the Arizona Supreme Court, what was their final word in that one, in the 13-1410 and then the 13-1407? What was their decision with Holly 2?
Well, that was their decision. We just talked about that, but there was one other development we should note. In 2017, from the state court, that was the end of it. But in 2017, the Arizona Federal District Court, which we talked just a little bit earlier, granted habeas relief under AEDPA to a defendant, and that was Stephen May, convicted in 2007 under that same section. And Senior District Judge Neil Wake concluded that Arizona had shifted the burden to the defendant in violation of Patterson, Mulaney, and Winship. And the district court found that Arizona is the only jurisdiction ever to uphold the constitutionality of putting the burden of disproving sexual intent on the accused. In the district court's analysis, Arizona had created a regime which everyone starts out guilty and law enforcement decides who has to prove himself innocent. And he said, there's a grievous threat to due process of law making defendants disprove their own state of mind for conduct that it's not wrongful in any sense way without a bad mental state. So in other words, you've got to show what your mind had going 6 years, 5 years, 3 years ago by the time this makes it to court.
And that was ultimately reversed.
Yes. But in an opinion that was filed simultaneously with that reversal, an unpublished disposition, Judge Frederick Block, who was on the court, noted that Arizona is the only state that places the burden of proving lack of intent on the defendant, and it will be the issue if it reached the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would agree with Judge Wake that it's unconstitutional.
Well, then during his second trial in 2017, Bagonski took the stand to raise the affirmative defense under Section 13-1407. Bagonski admitted at trial that he washed the girl's genitals with his bare hand during the Sunday bath. Wow, only Sunday? Anyway, but asserted that he was not motivated by any sexual interest. That sounds like he was forced to testify in order to assert the affirmative defense. Now, I thought the accused had a constitutional right to not testify.
Well, they do, except in Arizona. And Chance can weigh in here in a second because he's done 2,000 trials in his life. But what's funny is the jury instruction was given. Let me just let Chance weigh in here. Isn't that effectively neutering the person's right not to testify? If the only way you can assert it is to testify?
Absolutely. It's a clear violation.
So could you get up there and just do that? They could say, ask 10,000 questions and you say, I plead the fifth, whatever. But when asked this one question, you could answer it? I mean, wouldn't that sort of maintain your right?
Yeah, you could stipulate that you're answering this and that's the whole scope of the answer and that's that. Sure. But you're still testifying. And, if you exercise your right to be silent, then it should be respected. Period.
I see.
But what's funny is the jury instruction that was given. The jury was instructed as follows. The defendant has raised the affirmative defense of lack of sexual interest with respect to the charged offense of child molestation. The burden of proving each element of an offense beyond a reasonable doubt also remains with the state. However, this is what the jury was told. The burden of proving the affirmative defense of lack of sexual interest is on the defendant. The defendant must prove the affirmative defense of lack of sexual interest by preponderance of evidence. If you find that the defendant has proven the affirmative defense of lack of sexual interest by preponderance of the evidence, you must find the defendant not guilty of the offenses of child molestation. Well, I have a feeling that very few juries would ever come to that conclusion.
Yeah, just because you said so? Yeah, I agree with that. The jury returned not guilty verdicts on 3 CM charges involving one of the girls, but found Bagonski guilty of the 3 remaining charges of CM involving the other 2 girls. How many people are we talking about?
Apparently 3.
Because it said 3 that he was acquitted of, right? Not guilty, anyway. And then 3 he was found guilty of, 2 others, sorry.
Well, I think it was 3 counts with the same victim that he was acquitted of, if I understood it right. But it was a very confusing case. I can understand why you struggled for so long when you were reading it.
Well, not only that, people were talking to me all day. But then the Ninth Circuit stated on page 32, we have profound concerns with the substance of the Arizona scheme and with the Arizona Supreme Court's analysis in Holly 2. Those concerns persuaded us that Arizona has shifted the burden of proving the only fact that really matters in CM cases, whether the defendant touched the child's private parts with some kind of sexual motive.
Yep, and the court stated Arizona's child molestation scheme is not just broad, it's pernicious. What the hell does that mean, Chance?
Well, pernicious means it's ugly, very ugly, and absolutely horrendous. And terrible.
It criminalizes every knowing or intentional touching of a child's parts, no matter the reason. Everyone who knowingly changes a diaper could be convicted of child molestation, even when the state's proof of the fact is not proof of any evil interest, but only traditionally lawful conduct. The state's burden of proof under 13.14.10 is only a modest imposition on the prosecutor. But not everyone will be charged. Only those persons whom the prosecutor believes will not be able to prove a negative that the defendants did not have a sexual motive will be charged.
They stated Arizona has foisted the burden of proving the sexual motivation of the defendant on the defendant himself. This the state cannot do consistent with the due process clause. Every fact necessary to constitute the crime charged must be proven by the state beyond a reasonable doubt. The Supreme Court cases clearly establish that Arizona cannot shift the burden of proof to the defendant. I swear, Larry, I heard you say that a bazillion times about burden shifting with the May case.
I did, and that's what they did. And then they went on to say, we have little difficulty concluding that Arizona has shifted the burden from the state to the defendant to prove a core element of the child molestation statute, that the defendant touched the child's private parts with some kind of sexual interest. Arizona has done so in violation of due process clauses of the 14th Amendment, as clearly established in decisions of the United States Supreme Court. This is what they have to say to have a hope of this holding up. In Bogosky's case, the Arizona Court of Appeals was bound by Holly too, so they're giving them a pass because of that. But for the reasons we have explained, Holly too identified the correct legal principles in the Supreme Court's case, but its application of those principles was objectively an unreasonable one.
And the conclusion states, the judgment of the district court is reversed, and the matter is remanded to the district court to issue the writ of habeas corpus. All right, what's next?
Well, I would predict that there would be a request for reconsideration, which will be denied. Then there'll be a request for a hearing of the full court en banc. That, I think that has more likelihood of being granted. But ultimately, this matter is likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, because if I'm Bogosky's attorney, I ain't stopping here. If the full court convenes and overturns it, I'm not stopping here. And I'm going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, what happens there, who knows? But I think this case ultimately could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Do you want to? Well, let me ask first. Does this help May?
Not yet, but it might.
What would the hurdles or the milestones along the way?
Well, this has got to be upheld. The Arizona statute has got to be declared unconstitutional, and then he would move to vacate his conviction because he's being held on an unconstitutional statute that's been found unconstitutional. And that's why they're going to fight tooth and nail. They're not going to want to turn the prison gates open for all these child molesters that have been convicted under a non-constitutional statute. Now, it's funny because they raise their hand and they put that one on the Bible that they are seeking justice and that they want to do the right thing, but they will fight like hell to keep these people behind bars, even under a non-constitutional conviction. Now, that's funny. Admit that.
No, I need you to go back. You didn't put enough eyes in there when you said that word.
I did.
You didn't put enough eyes. You need at least 10 eyes when you say Bible.
Okay, and the Bible.
There you go. That's much better. Interesting. So, I mean, he's still locked up for some number of years, but potentially he doesn't end up spending the rest of his life there.
Well, if the U.S. Supreme Court gets this case and they have the final word and they agree with the panel, then I don't think Arizona will have much choice, but they'll slow roll it. They'll do everything they can. I mean, they're not going to want to let people out of prison. I don't know why. I can't explain that. They claim they're overworked, understaffed, short-staffed, and they claim they're the guardians of the purse and all this kind of stuff, but they don't want to let go of anybody. I've never figured that out.
Huh, weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, okay. From the intersection of law, policy, and public safety in California, this is California Corner. This is your source for clear legal insight into the laws that govern California PFR Registry. Now, welcome to today's segment, which is California's SB 680, or as I like to call it, the bill that said, no more creepy age gaps. Senate Bill 680, authored by Senator Susan Rubio, just passed the California Senate Public Safety Committee 4-1. Now, it targets a gap, otherwise known as a legal loophole, in the state's sex offender registry law that's been letting certain PFRs, particularly in cases involving minors, avoid mandatory registration. Basically, it's like the legal equivalence of patching a hole in your boat after you've already started sinking. Or as I like to say, Chance, I like to build the parachute after I've already jumped out of the airplane. Now, correct. I am joined by Chance, a criminal defense attorney, whose practice is primarily focused on PFR-type crimes in California. Chance Oberstein, thanks for being here, or should I say, taking a chance on us.
All right. Thank you, Andy. As I see, you're already trying out your stand-up routine, but let
I'm
me
thinking
start
about getting
first.
Rid of my day job.
Okay. I think I would agree with that.
Well, can we start with the basics? What exactly is the loophole in Senate Bill 680, and what is this aiming to close?
Okay. Well, Andy, under current California law, most sexual abuse crimes involving minors, including acts like oral copulation and sodomy, carry an automatic sex offender registration requirement. It's mandatory. But there's an exception, the charge of unlawful sexual intercourse, which is often used when the defendant is more than 10 years older than the minor. It's treated really as less severe. In other words, the law was basically saying, sure, you're 20 years older, but hey, no big deal. SB 680 changes that.
And no more Lolita loopholes? Is that right?
Exactly. But don't worry. The Romeo and Juliet exceptions are still kind of intact. So if you're a high school senior dating a freshman, you may be safe from the law, at least. Your parents' judgment, well, that's another story.
And the bill has been amended since it was first introduced. The original version could have put tens of thousands on the registry retroactively. Is that what I understand?
Yeah, that was the problem. Early drafts would have applied it to past convictions. And this is the threat of most things coming through the tube from our legislators, potentially adding up to 30,000 individuals. That's a lot of people suddenly Googling, asking how to explain this to my neighbors. But the amended version now says only those convicted on or after January 1st, 2026 will be required to register.
Well, would you do us the service of breaking down what this bill does and does not do? Feel free to use bullet points, because who doesn't love a good list?
I'd love to make a good list, but it's a very short list. And here's what it does. And bullet point number one requires mandatory sex registration for unlawful sex with a minor if the offender is more than 10 years older or if the offender has committed the offense more than once, even with a smaller age gap. It brings these cases in line with other offenses against minors and the way they're treated in California. What it doesn't do, bullet point one, is it doesn't create new crimes. So no need to panic unless you've already are breaking the law.
And the advocacy angle?
Supporters of this say that it closes a loophole that has allowed predators to escape long-term oversight and has left victims with uneven legal protections. In other words, in their view, it's about accountability and consistency in the law. In practical terms, it says no more Lolita exceptions.
But let's be real. If you're using Lolita as your dating manual, you probably got bigger problems?
Much bigger problems. I agree with that. But remember, registry laws aren't static. They evolve as lawmakers address unintended consequences or swipe at low-hanging fruit.
Now, speaking of low-hanging fruit, Chance, thanks for walking us through this.
Anytime. And good luck with that comedy career.
I hope it works out for me. Thanks, Chance. Now, the bill now heads to the Senate Appropriations Committee. What do you think will happen as that moves about, Larry?
Well, I wish I knew as much about California legislative process, but this is a bill that's hard to be in opposition to. This is one of those things where you have to have a good relationship with some key committee members, and it has to quietly fade off into the oblivion. And that's even more difficult in a year-round legislative assembly like California. When you're dealing with a 30 and 60, 90-day session, you've got 1,200 bills moving, and if one fades off the radar, unless it's really being forced by a lot of power behind it, nobody notices. But this one is going to be tough because you can't vote against this. It's just politically, potentially suicidal to vote against it. So I say it, your best hope is going to Senate appropriations is to try to make an economic impact. Governor Newsom is already dealing with a huge budget deficit. So try to figure out how to bloat the cost of this thing beyond what anybody can imagine. And I don't know how to do that because I don't know what all the ramifications fiscally would be. But if you can get appropriations to stall the damn thing, that might be a strategy to see if you can make it die, wither on the vine.
Correct. It's all there.
Just wouldn't that be 30,000 people potentially that now you have to have registry officers doing compliance checks and all that other garbage?
No, because they're eliminated because it's not retroactive.
It would just be the new people?
Be the new people. But the real problem with this is not that. I mean, the real problem with this is the legislative intent of having sex with a minor set at 18. The reason it's done in California is because too many adults were impregnating too many underage girls. And so that's how the law came about. That's why they set it at 18. It was a deterrent. But the reason it's discretionary is because beyond the deterrent, if the child happens, then financial responsibility kicks in. Well, the reason, the biggest reason why the law was set at 18 is they didn't, you know, the legislators didn't want California to become a welfare state. The biggest reason it's discretionary registration is because those adult men who did that also need to work and pay for what they did. It's called financial responsibility. And if you now have mandatory registration and that registration gets in between that person, that individual finding a job or not, you've defeated the whole purpose of raising the age to 18 in the first place. So it just doesn't seem like a very bright idea.
All right. Larry, shall we move over to this DC thing from Courthouse News Service?
Yes, but do you want me to tell you something funny?
I do want you to tell me something funny.
Apparently, I didn't hit the button correctly, and it's not recording for me. I hope you've got something that's capturing this.
Wow. I thought you, like, when we started, you said, I got to go check this and check this and check this. Wow. Tonight was, like, the one night that I actually made a backup copy.
Well, thankfully, because, yeah, I didn't. It either didn't take or I didn't hit it. I thought I hit it. But anyway, okay, so where are we going next?
All right. Well, from Courthouse News, a D.C. Circuit panel on Tuesday declined to freeze the implementation of a universal national registry for non-citizens in the United States over 30 days, setting up further arguments before the appeals court in the fall. In a per curiam order, U.S. Circuit Judges Karen Henderson, Robert Wilkes, and Bradley Garcia, appointed by Ronald Reagan, holy moly, they must be 100 years old, Barack Obama and Joe Biden, respectively, the panel declined the immigrants' rights group's request for a stay, finding they failed to satisfy the stringent requirements needed. And what did they fail to satisfy?
Well, I looked at that very brief order, and it was devoid of details, but I'm guessing that the panel, which was a balanced bipartisan panel, felt that they didn't show that they were likely to succeed on the merits, and that, nor that they would suffer irreparable harm. It's both of those. You've got to show that you're likely to succeed on the merits and that you will be irreparably harmed but for the injunction without that being granted. My guess is they didn't feel the evidence was there. And again, not liking something doesn't make it unconstitutional simply because you don't like it. And I don't like registries, but registries have been upheld as not being unconstitutional. And that's probably what they looked at and said, well, registering somebody is not unconstitutional in and of itself.
So in summary, for me dumb people, this is making a illegal immigrant database registry?
That's what I've heard. I don't know the details, but that's what I've heard people complain about that are immigrants' rights advocates, that they're trying to create this massive database for. And I think they've encouraged immigrants to sign up for it. But again, I'm not certain of all the details. But just FYI is the reason I put it in here. When you ask for an injunction, be prepared with evidence. Evidence has got to include that you're going to win with existing case law, that your case aligns with existing the body of case law, and that without this, you will be irreparably harmed. Same thing that went wrong.
I think
wrong.
We should create registries for effectively every person in the country, and then we should create a registry of people who have created registries.
Well, there was an advocate out there that tried that. He created a registry for the officers and put the officers' pictures on it. You remember that guy?
I do not know about that one.
I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to start a flame war, but you know, there's an advocate out there that created a registry for the people who register PFRs.
Can you tell me where this person... Do I know this person?
Yes, you would know this person, but like I said, I don't want to start a war.
This isn't somebody in New York, is it?
No. No, it's not.
Okay. Then I have no idea. I have no idea. So this is going to be a registry for only the officers that do PFR registrations?
Yes.
That's... Okay. See, that's funny. All right. Well, then you put in... This is from the Albuquerque, New Mexico, reported by the Associated Press. And it says, failed political candidate was sentenced to 80 years in federal prison Wednesday for his conviction in a series of drive-by shootings at the homes of state and local lawmakers in the aftermath of the 2020 election. What is this about?
Well, it's about a former Republican candidate named Solomon Pena, who was early this year convicted of several charges, conspiracy and weapons and the shootings. But he went by the homes of Democratic elected officials firing into their homes, and including the current Speaker of the House of Representatives. And prosecutors had sought a 90-year sentence, but the judge graciously reduced it to a more reasonable amount. But the prosecutor said that Pena had shown no remorse and had hoped to cause political change by terrorizing people who held contrary views to him, being too afraid to take part of the political life. This was big news here when it was happening, when the shootings were happening, and then with the prosecution. But yeah, this is 80 years seems a little bit harsh when nobody was killed or even hit by the bullets.
No, I wasn't paying a lot of attention. I just heard you guys talking about it in pre-show. This sounds exactly like, wasn't it in Minnesota where the guy was shooting up politicians' houses and killed two people?
Yes, there was. There
Isn't
was
this shooting. Exactly the same thing?
Well, I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but it was certainly, there was a shooting in Minnesota of two people. I think a lawmaker was one of them, if I remember right.
And his wife. And he had like set up to, he had like a whole map made up of all the places he was going to go to that night. And I believe he made it to two houses and ultimately killed a husband and wife, a lawmaker and his wife, if I'm not mistaken.
So, yeah, well, this is our version of that, but fortunately no one was hurt.
Yeah, fortunately. All right, well, then the article states Pena's lawyers had sought a 60-year sentence, saying their client maintains that he is innocent of the charges. They have said Pena was not involved in the shootings and that prosecutors were relying on the testimony of two men who bear responsibility and accepted plea agreements in exchange for leniency. Could he be innocent?
Well, I think Mr. Chance is a better person to answer that. Sure, he could be, but the jury convicted him. So in the eyes of the law, he is a guilty person. Attacks took place as threats of acts of intimidation against election workers and public officials had surged across the country after President Trump and his allies called into question the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. That was the impetus for a lot of violence that happened thereafter. It was all that craziness about how corrupt it is and how this election was stolen and blah, blah, blah.
Prosecutors said Pena resorted to violence in the belief that a rigged election had robbed him of victory in his bid to serve in the state legislature. The shootings targeted the homes of officials, including two county commissioners, after their certification of the 2022 election, in which Pena lost by nearly 50 percentage points. I mean, mathematically, how do you lose by 50? Did he get zero?
He got a very small number of votes.
No one was injured, but in one case, bullets passed through the bedroom of a senator's 10-year-old daughter.
Well, I'm not rationalizing it at all. It's not anything that's funny or rationalizable, but 80 years does seem like a pretty harsh outcome. But we are in federal court, and two other men who acknowledged helping Pena with attacks had previously pleaded guilty to the federal charges, and they received long prison sentences. I don't remember how much. But I've been thinking maybe the president will intervene for Mr. Pena. He's intervened for others who have done things of this nature. So this guy didn't kill anybody, and so he's real concerned about people getting harsh sentences. And it seems like to me that this would be a good candidate for him to step up and say, hey, let me commute this 80-year sentence down to time served.
Do you mean harsh sentences for terrorist acts? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, that's what I was just going to ask. I mean, weren't people on January 6th, didn't some police officers die that day and they were, exonerated, commuted, whatever the word is?
Well, there were some that were commuted and some I think were just pardoned altogether, but... You know, this is really sad to me, but it is an excessive sentence, I would say, for a person who didn't really physically harm anybody. And it would be one where, if I were in the position to, I would look at that along with his remorse and his life history and a lot of things to determine that he was treated excessively harsh, you know, for the conduct.
Interesting. But like mathematically, I mean, you have to generally get 50% to, you know, something like, oh, this candidate won by 54%. And if he lost by 54, he got single digits?
No.
And he's really pissed off at...
You get 75% of the vote. That's 50% more than somebody else got. If the person got 75 to 25, that's 50% more.
That's right. He got a very small number. It wasn't like it was a 4 or 5 point... What did Trump win by, like a handful of percentage points?
I think it's less than 2%. But yeah, this guy had mental problems. And what's funny is had he got elected, he would be serving in the Capitol here. Wouldn't that be funny?
That would be amazing. Okay. We are at 50 minutes. Is there anything else you guys would like to talk about for about 2 or 3 minutes? Or should we just close it all down?
Close this mother down.
Chance, any final words? Do you want to plug your podcast? How's that going?
Hey, that's going really good. You know,
how can people find it?
They can find it by going to YouTube and looking up Sex Crimes Defense. That would do it.
And we're not allowed to stop yet. Deanna still has alcohol left. Just saying.
Whoa.
I do want to mention that we did get a new patron a couple weeks back, and his name is Owen. I say welcome to the family. You can get your account joined over on between Patreon and Discord, and you can just automatically come and hang out with us on Saturday nights while we're recording this. Well, head over to registrymatters.co to find show notes, and you can find links to everything as far as downloading it or find YouTube and all the other places where you could find the podcast if you need to do that. Send email over to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. We did receive email from people this week that I keep forwarding over to Larry, and I believe Larry has been responding to some of the people, and that might turn into segments on the show. So don't hesitate to send those emails over. Am I right on that one, Larry?
You're right about one in particular that believes that the being listed on the website triggers an IML passport marking, and I'm trying to debunk that, but it's going to take more research than I can do. So I just have to apply logic to it, but I don't believe that that's the case. But it's a very good scenario that he's put together, because if it turns out that he's right, that would be a tragedy, because I would have to up my belief that being on the website is more damaging than it's damaging enough. But I think I might have to rethink if it turns out that merely being on the website generates that. I don't believe it does, but it could.
All right. You can also leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. And as I stated at the beginning of the show, patreon.com/registrymatters if you would like to become a supporter, which we would appreciate so very much. And gentlemen, I hope you have a fabulous night, and I will talk to you guys soon. I hope you have a good night. Take care.
Thank you. Good night. Thanks.
Good night, and apologize for the lack of recording. Hopefully you have all you need.
I hope so. If not, we'll just record it again.
That would be definitely funny.
You've been listening to FYP.